Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 26, I believe. And the topic for today is going to be Intelligent Systems Service. This is a brand new service that it's available on Windows Azure in preview form, I might add. And it's still very sketchy in terms of details, but there's a lot of potential to the service. And me and the guys figured it was worth discussing and opening it up for people to, you know, get interested in it and go and sign up for the preview if they find this kind of stuff interesting. So anyway, just to do the quick round of introductions, I know we've done this very often, but my name is Sujit Mello. I'm a consultant with Microsoft, focused on app dev, and on Skype I have my two esteemed colleagues, Kale and Evan. Guys?
Yeah, this is Kale. I'm an MCS consultant in the New York, New Jersey region as well, in the app dev and Azure space.
And my name is Evan Vasek, and I'm on the Windows on Azure team supporting Azure IaaS.
Right. Yeah, good to be back with the old gang again. So, you know, listeners might remember back in episode 18, I believe it was, we did cover a topic called the Internet of Things, or IoT, as it's often referred to today. And you guys might remember, I think it was Kale, was that you who brought Ryan Berry to the show?
Yep.
Yeah. So that was really nice of you to bring him in. And he was a great host, a great guest to have on the show, because he had built this little system that using the .NET embedded device, where he was gathering temperature information from his house and uploading it to a service instance on Windows Azure, processing it, you know, putting it into a queue, and then doing some processing on it, putting it into a database, and a little front end where you could go and analyze the data in the database. And, you know, it was a nice use of, you know, technologies, both on the client side in that using .NET on the .NET Compact Edition, as well as using .NET in Azure to do some of this processing. And, you know, when we saw that, and more recently when Microsoft came out with this new service called the Intelligent System Service, it kind of got us thinking, at least got me thinking, that what Ryan did was very, very typical of what anybody would do if they were to hook up any sort of intelligent device. Okay, intelligent sensor, and we'll come to some of the various devices that you can connect up in this way. But there seems to be this pattern that you would have to implement over and over again. You know, the data collection part of it, the queuing, the data collection, and then the processing, and then the analysis, and then the manageability. So I think what Microsoft has done in this intelligent system service is they've tried to combine a lot of these facilities into an easy-to-use service. I mean, Kale, I know it's kind of things are a little sketchy, but what are your thoughts on this new initiative from Microsoft?
Yeah, so when I first heard about this and I started reading just the little bits that are even out there right now, it feels to me like, and I could be totally off base here, but it feels to me like it's like we did with the mobile services, where in order to build an application that runs on mobile services, like a phone or a tablet or something of that nature, that's not a PC that's hardwired into something, we built this service around it called mobile services, where it would encompass, you know, setting up the database, even doing some of the table storage if you wanted, and building this API, like scaffolding an API up for you. So lowering the bar to build that stuff. It feels like this is the same thing. Like, so we have these small devices out here now that can provide telemetry and all kinds of information about the world around us. And that's great, but, you know, in the past it was a, you know, we had to pull these things out and dock them somewhere and pull them into a database and then do something with this data. But now, you know, things are becoming more connected. People want to be able to do that seamlessly. And it feels to me like we're trying to build a service offering to lower the bar, to set these kind of things up and have like some of the basic analytics and those types of things available like out of the box.
Yeah, you know, when I think about that, I kind of think about when I talk to customers who are developing apps, right, and they have to think about, okay, what's PaaS, what's IaaS, where do I put my storage, how do I build my VNet, you know, all that kind of stuff to get your data flow right through all your pieces. And I think, you know, I kind of agree with you, Kale, is it feels like we're moving in a direction and say, hey, we'll just kind of build this basic scaffolding for you, which includes, you know, maybe some PaaS roles to do certain things and some IaaS roles to do certain things. And it's, you just drop it all in place. And right, here's your setup.
Absolutely. Right? I think you guys hit it on the head there. Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, cause I mean, even, just something as simple as auth, right? I don't know if you guys have ever written code that does authentication. That's a pain, right? Cause you have to have some place to store it and what credentials to use. And now we've got this Azure AD scenario, but you know, my guess is that some people want to use a custom, a directory. Some people want to tie it into their corporate, but you don't want to do all the plumbing work in your code and your service.
Exactly. And even what, you know, if you go back to what Ryan built, Ryan Berry, and what he built, it was, I could say just like a hobby that he, you know, as a hobby, he built a little system, and it was, you know, fairly complicated, a lot of moving parts to it, and it wasn't even enterprise ready. I mean, if you want to take that system and make it enterprise ready, I think you're talking of a lot more work, yeah, you know, in terms of making it robust, having retry mechanisms, making sure you don't lose messages, the security aspect of it, as we talked about, all of that, to plug it all in, that's going to take a lot of work. And I think you're right, you guys are right that, you know, I think Microsoft's decided to pull all that stuff together into a well-established pattern, you know, using best practices that they have encountered using with some of their customers that they have worked with in the past, and put all that together into a solid package offering.
Yeah, the other thing that strikes me is, if you guys remember when we were talking to Ryan, you know, we were talking about, you know, hey, why did you use a web role for this piece versus a Windows Azure website? Why did you use, you know, a SQL Server instance versus Azure SQL Database? All those kind of things,
mm-hmm.
right? When we kind of do this as a custom service, and some of it, let me step back. Some of it, his answers were, well, it's just kind of easier for me to stand that up because I kind of knew how to do that, right? But it wasn't necessarily the cheapest or the most scalable way to do it.
Right.
Right. So you can definitely see on this where we say, hey, we're going to do an Azure SQL database. And oh, by the way, we can grow to this size and we can shard it out and we can, you know, we're going to do it. We're going to deploy your code as a Windows Azure website.
Right.
Right. Rather than a web role. I mean, one of the things, if you look at what I think is the coolest thing about some of the Azure development that we see today, right? You go into Visual Studio and you have this kind of pre-built framework where you just have to start writing your code. You don't have to build a lot of plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
And you deploy it, and it just knows how to tie those things up together.
Yep.
Right. And yeah. I think this is definitely going to be, you know, kind of down that same path.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, here's a prime example of this morning. So I'm off site. I'm at a customer. I've been up here for a couple of weeks in a different state, and I was sitting at breakfast this morning, and true story, this guy sits down next to me and he just starts talking to me, and he was into biotech research. Mm. And so when he started talking about things, he just asked where I worked, and we talked a little bit, and then he said, yeah, I mean, the technology thing is, he wasn't a technologist at all. He was very much into his DNA sequencing and these types of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, yep.
And he was mentioning about some products they were building, and it was hilarious because he knew like a lot of technology, and he even said, I'm not a technologist, but he started talking about the cloud and how they're leveraging, you know, these different cloud providers to do this analysis because they can't support it on site anymore, and they need big data, and he starts dropping these terms, and I'm just like, wow, like the stuff is out there everywhere. Like, people know these things. You know, so.
Yeah, no, I was just working with a customer last night, who, and it kind of floored me because it's not quite the architecture that I would recommend. But these guys, they have some big set of data crunching they do once a quarter, right? So some sort of analysis on some big chunk of, you know, of summary data. And they're deploying 1,000 four-core VMs to do that.
Holy cow, that's a lot.
So they're gonna spin them up. They're gonna run it. I think he was saying that they run it. You know, it takes a couple, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 days to run, because this is all big parallel processing job. And they can actually compress the amount of time it takes to run by doing that many machines versus whatever they did on premises. And then they're just gonna shut it down. And then in a quarter they'll spin it back up and shut it back down.
That's exactly
right now. And what was interesting, and kind of like, Kale, like what you were saying about the guy you were talking to, this guy clearly, right, wasn't super comfortable with the technology aspect, right? But he was super interested and super excited about the enabling of his ability to really kind of do his work significantly faster.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting from this guy too. He wasn't into the technology. He wasn't really like, wow, we can really scale and do these things. He didn't care about that. He was caring about like how fast they could do the jobs that they needed to do cancer research or whatnot they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that was pretty cool, because it was like, these things are really enabling. And that's why I think this is important. If you have this service that lowers that bar, you're still going to need some people that understand some of the bits and the technology, but it doesn't require, you know, a rocket scientist to have something like what you're even talking about, Evan, these 1,000 node clusters that do this crazy amount of number crunching.
Yeah, I mean, on premises, that's a huge thing. The hardware aspect of how do I get those suckers deployed,
mm-hmm.
right? Nobody wants to do. So,
right,
yeah.
And then you keep them around for the whole month and use them for just a couple of days.
Yeah, well, you keep around for the whole year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's even worse.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I was just thinking, I said, like, you know, so why is this IoT thing seems to have been kicked up into high gear all of a sudden? You know, I think in the last few years, big data has dominated the landscape. And when it comes to big data, they talk about, you know, getting all this data from social media, right? Lots and lots of data coming in there, and combining that with some on-premises information that you might have, and creating, you know, coming up with some sort of intelligent results out of all that information. And it seems to be that the Internet of Things is probably just an extension of this big data problem, the way I see it, because we're talking about having all these sensors out there, and, you know, we can talk about some of the various scenarios that you would use this technology. I think it's usable almost everywhere, but you're talking of a lot of information here, right, which is potentially being generated. And, you know, when we talked about our big data solution on our big data episode, I forget when we did it, it was earlier on the year, the three main characteristics of big data were the three V's, as they call them, right? Volume, variety, and velocity. So clearly, when you're talking about all these sensors out there generating data, you definitely have a lot of volume of data. They're coming in fast, right? So you have the velocity. And then they're coming in from just various kinds of sensors sending different kinds of data back to you, and so you get that variety as well. And so if you think about it, right, this is a very typical big data problem. But there's a little extra aspect to it, is the part of collecting the information and storing it for processing is different from a typical big data kind of scenario. In big data, you know, you would use tools to do ETL jobs to get information into Azure, and then spin up HD Insight to process them. Here, it looks like we have to have a different system to collect all the data and get it into this intelligent system service before it can be processed. So, if, I don't know, but what do you guys feel about that? Does it look like a similar issue to big data? Or
I mean, my take is, like, when I see big data stuff, typically, it really feels, and I think your statement about ETL stuff is kind of, you know, clinches it, or in my head it's very planned. Right, I'm doing this big batch of data. I suck it in. I make some conclusions, and then I come back, you know, a week, 2 weeks later, and rerun it, and then look at it again.
Mm-hmm.
when we look at the Internet of Things stuff, it really feels much more ongoing, right? You're just always getting this data in and reacting to
it. It's always on kind of thing.
Yeah, you don't really have the opportunity to say, hey, I've got my data, stop, analyze it.
Right.
It's just kind of this on-the-fly, you know, temperature. The temperature stuff's a great example, right? The temperature data keeps coming in.
Yeah.
Right, and you want your system to respond to that real time. I certainly don't want my thermostat only adjusting once a day. Right, so.
True.
That's yeah, I think point. One thing else, another little story that this was probably more than 10 years ago. So I'm a big IndyCar fanatic. I used to be like heavily involved because I was working for a company who sponsored some Indy racers, and the technology then, I mean, this was over 10 years ago, was mind boggling. I mean, when they would, drive these cars, you know, they're doing 220 miles an hour and go into a corner, they had laser sensors to know, like, how far that car, like, the right front of that car dipped when it went into that corner.
Yeah.
And literally real time in the pits, those guys were seeing that data and could know how to adjust. Okay, this is what we need to change because the temperature changed and blah, 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 all these things. And it was mind-boggling. But now, like a couple weeks ago, I just saw that Indy is actually going to start publishing that data stream to people. Like
I saw that. It's going to be accessible real-time to consumers.
That blows me away. Like real-time, as you're watching this thing on TV, you're going to have this mountain of data that could literally come through and be able to see all that telemetry. That's wild. I mean,
yeah, what? Oh,
yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Sajid. I was going to just say a little tidbit on that, though. I mean, I know IndyCar is just doing it. I'm a big NASCAR fan, by the way. And NASCAR and NASCAR has been doing it for over a year, more than 2 years, by the way.
So they do the telemetry already?
Full telemetry streaming on the Internet. You can see every possible sensor they have. Now, mind you, NASCAR is not as technical, you know, in terms of all this high-tech stuff as IndyCar is.
Ooh,
so
careful.
The number of
careful. You might start
I know. It's
all
separate,
war at that
all
point.
Separate discussion, especially talking to somebody like Evan down there. But, you know, I don't want to get into trouble. Sorry, Evan. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I mean, when you think about – we talk about this Internet of Things stuff. You know, one of the things – that strikes me, especially when we talk about this NASCAR stuff, like the first thing that pops in my head is, ooh, it'd be cool to write an app to do that, like to show something that I cared about, right? And, but then it becomes the question of, like, who in all these scenarios, whose data is it, right? And who decides to be free with their data and who decides to kind of put a paywall or a service there, you know?
Yeah, I think it would be interesting if they actually, like, published feeds, right? If it got to the point where they could publish these feeds, and then you could consume it and build apps on top of it, you know?
Yeah, so, build your own stuff at that point. Yeah, I think, Sajid, you were talking about the Easy Pass that you guys have up north.
Right.
All around that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So just it's a good segue into some of the use cases for this kind of service. So up in the Northeast here, I know not so much where Evan is down in the Carolinas, but up in the Northeast, we're unfortunately have to deal with a lot of toll roads over here. And a lot of the cars, I would say most of the cars and trucks and whatnot, are outfitted with this little tag. They call it an Easy Pass tag. It's a little transponder that you attach to the car. Some have it inside the car, some have it in the front of the car near the license plate. And the main use case for that transponder is, of course, to collect, to know when you're entering the roadway and when you're exiting and charge you the toll automatically. But they've also expanded it now where they have these tag readers on various highways. And so they're collecting a lot of information. They're talking about, you know, I don't know, I'm going to say like more than hundreds of cars a minute at least that are passing a typical road. And then there's all the roads and all the various points that they collect this information. So they get all this info, and they can do a lot of intelligent things with it. For example, they could figure out if there's an accident somewhere, because a lot of cars would have passed a particular zone, but they wouldn't have passed the other next zone. So they would figure out that, hold on, for some reason everybody stopped over here. There's got to be something wrong there. And that's, you know, that's typical analysis that you could do. Or they could look at the if there was a traffic jam or slow down, they could analyze the average speed of all the cars that are flowing through a particular road. So Just a little, a good kind of, I always thought of that being a great use case for something like this, intelligent systems.
Yeah, I think the interesting question to me that you talk about that data, like, and I just don't know, is whose data is that?
Yeah.
Right? It's your EasyPass, but obviously, I think those are like regional companies or something, but.
The ownership of the data. Yeah, that's very
important. Yeah, somebody owns the data, but it's data about you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, could they turn around and sell that to the police? I and all of a sudden you get this ticket in the mail. Right?
Yeah, I'm hoping that, I mean, I'm assuming it's anonymized in some way, you know, when they process it. They're looking at just, you know, trying to figure out how things are moving along on a particular roadway.
But I think that's the interesting piece around some of this stuff is we're all super interested in that. And there's this whole other aspect of, like, what do you do with this data in our company? Do you, like, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, Sajid, you and I have talked about this before. Like, we both have Fitbits.
Mm-hmm.
Fitbit, you know, has all this data on me. But they actually say in their terms and conditions, hey, we don't sell it. We don't, you know, we don't do anything with your data. It's yours. But, like, and not that Fitbit's going to go out of business tomorrow, but if they went out of business, I could see some companies say, hey, this is data that we can sell to try and,
yeah,
you know, monetize it, you know, while we liquidate, right?
Yeah. And even if, you know, while Fitbit is still around, they can take all this information of all their Fitbit users, and as long as it's in an anonymous way and there's no tie-up to the original user, like you or me, I really don't care if they use the data for some good, right? They're processing it. They're trying to see, you know, is everybody generally doing more exercise or less exercise? You know, how's the trend of the nation as a general rule, you know?
Right.
And I think there's a lot of good that can come out of that by analyzing this information. Like, do people really do exercise in the morning? Do they do mostly in the afternoon? You know, and there's so much you can understand from that, from looking at that telemetry. The other thing that it monitors is sleep patterns, right? It sees how well you're sleeping, and that's another thing you can draw a lot of conclusions by just doing a very anonymous analysis of all this data.
Yeah, they were, and now we're starting to talk about some of the data stuff, but there was with all the Medicare data that they just released,
mm-hmm.
right? These doctors they're going looking and saying, hey, what procedures, you know, were done, and what was the outcome, and how often were they done? Just these reams and reams of data, right?
Yes.
So you're right. There's all kinds of the internet thing is all about generating all that data.
Yep.
And then you got to go figure out what to do with it.
Yeah. So it's a good thing that we're talking about the data, because I think that's one thing we're really good at, right? We've an established track record, the Microsoft Data Platform. We mentioned HD Insight, which is our Hadoop big data processing engine. We've got SQL Server, of course. The BI, our BI processing, and our BI tools that we have for doing this. Because it's one thing to have all this data. It's a completely different thing to make sense of it.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
You really have to have world-class tools. I think we have the best tools. Power Pivot, the Excel. What's that tool? Excel Power BI?
Power View?
Power View, yeah, right. Power View.
There's all these power somethings. I can never keep them straight.
A whole bunch of these power tools plug into Excel, and you know, if you know how to use Excel, you can analyze this data. It's really that simple. I think that kind of, you know, really tells a very powerful story where you not only have all the bits and pieces to collect the information and store it, but you can also process it now and analyze it.
Yeah, and kind of bringing this in some ways also back around to the cloud piece. I know I was working with a customer a few months back where they were trying to figure out, you know, they were building some sort of medical system, right, where they were going to collect kind of real-time medical data like we've been talking about. And the reason they were looking at the cloud is because they kind of did the math and said, oh, my God, we're going to have 2 terabytes worth of data every month.
Wow.
Right? We just can't buy on-premises storage for that, right?
Yeah, and Evan, just like when I was talking to that gentleman this morning, one of his concerns about the storage, he said, you know, for years we've built, and they've been working on this for a few years, mostly on-premises stuff. He said we weren't using the cloud because there was regulatory things and all this kind of jazz about what we can store there. Now some of those bars have been lowered, but the certifications are in place now.
Mm-hmm.
But He was saying, you know, we could do it when it was terabytes of data, when it was tens of terabytes of data. But the thing is, he said, especially in his line of work, was when we do analysis, we have a data set, right? So we have this core data that we got from just like this, like the Internet of Things. We got this thing that generated some data. Mm-hmm. And that data, that core data, we want to keep that. That's very powerful for us to have because we do analysis on it and we get some output, and the output's very small. Like it's a spreadsheet, like it's a couple meg of data that gives you some sort of summary about what this data was about. But he said, you know, as those algorithms mature and as we do more things and more research into it, we can go back and regrind on that data again. And so it's important for us to not lose that. So like he said, when we set up, you know, our data models here now, it's like, well, we could do it on premise, but we have to store it at least two times, if not more, because this data is very expensive to get. And so he said the cloud really is going to lead the way there because, you know, when you have these things like you have in Azure where, you know, it's automatically, you know, replicated inside one data center, but also geo-replicated, and you're paying, you know, pennies for this.
Yep.
You just can't. You can't compete with that. You know?
Yeah, no, and you get the we were talking about this with somebody else, and in that scenario, not only do you have the replication, you know, and at cheap levels, but you almost don't have to worry about your data's consistency.
Yeah.
Right, because of the replication, we get, you know, we confirm the writes, right? And on premises, man, everybody's seen disk rot, right? Some file just goes, and you have that one copy, and you're done. So.
So. You know what? I just want to just kind of wind up by just thinking about what makes an intelligent system. In other words, we have all these sensors, right? Like I have a thermostat at home, obviously. I mean, that's not intelligent. I don't think so. I mean, what are some of the attributes that you guys can think that make up an intelligent system?
So there's a white paper out there that's like super early again, but it's about the intelligence system service, and it basically lists out five capabilities.
Okay.
And I don't want this to turn into a presentation, but there's you know, it's the obvious things about, first off, like how do you connect these things? So if you talk about these devices, it's great that they can generate data, but how can they connect to some place, some repository to store their data or upload their data? Mm-hmm. Just like when Ryan was on, was talking about, you know, when you use these small devices, some have Wi-Fi connections, some have cellular. Sometimes they're very primitive because they have very tiny processors, and sometimes they're more advanced. But being able to accomplish a connectivity when it's, you know, the smallest device that only has a 3G connection and all the way up to, you know, a backbone of the Internet or something.
And just to be clear, that it doesn't have to be real-time connectivity, right? As long as there's some way of periodically uploading that data.
Right.
It doesn't have to be on all the time. I mean, is that any, are you saying that it has to be real-time?
No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying that the platform, the service, should provide a low bar to be able to connect these devices.
Yep.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's really what allows this to be, you know, to go from a bunch of isolated things to the Internet of Things, right? Because it's that connectivity, right, that drives it. I think the other big thing that I see about all this stuff is the, for lack of a better word, learning, right, in the sense of the devices are doing something with the data.
Mm.
Right, it's not just the service is doing something with the data. It feeds it back to the device a lot of times, and then the device does something with that.
So it's talking about like more like manageability of the devices, two-way communication.
Yeah, conceptually, I think that's a big focus for most of this stuff. So
yep.
Yeah, to kind of tie off on the thing you were talking about, Sajid, about EasyPass. The other company that comes to mind is Waze.
Mm.
Who that Israeli company? I think Google bought them, but they were they did something unique where basically as people were driving, if you subscribed to the service and you provided input from your car, like hey, there's a cop here, hey, there's a traffic jam here, that data then immediately flowed through the cloud back down to other people's devices, and they could see that data. And when you get a lot of people doing that. It's very powerful because,
crowdsourcing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, definitely.
And then let's say, I'm just thinking of some of the other things. So obviously, I think having, you know, identity is also often described as one of the attributes of an intelligence system, because you want to collect the right data in the right context and give it to the right person. You know, so there's all these identity aspects of the system. You just don't want to, you know, unnecessarily collect information just for the heck of it. There's got to be a use and a purpose for it.
Definitely.
And then hand in hand with identity always comes security. I think that's in my mind, that is the most scary part of the whole intelligence systems service or the IoT system in general, is the fact that you have all these devices out there and, you know, whether someone's going to be able to tap into them and steal your data, so to speak. What else? What are the other attributes that we think we have in intelligent systems?
I think one of the other big ones would be being able to extend it easily. So being able to adapt. To Evan's point earlier, not having to sit down and plan out every detail of what you're going to do with this data for the next 5 years is a big thing. Like being able to say, let's just spin this up and let's get it running and see what happens. Okay, that didn't work, or this worked better. Let's go ahead and adjust it, and being able to be agile in that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were talking about the service that we're building, the system that we're building.
The intelligence,
you know, you think
system
about the code first model. Yeah, the intelligence service. I mean, you look at the code first model where it says you don't know anything about your database structure.
Right.
Because that's where people get themselves spun up, is they have this relational data or this tabular data, and they're like, oh, now I want this other thing. And now I got to like recode everything and check all my code. And now with all the code first things that we do, you can just say, I don't care what my data structure is. Just make that work for me.
Yeah.
I want to add this field, add this property, whatever. And that, like you're saying, Kel, that allows you to kind of just on the fly say, hey, I'm going to pick up this new piece of information and go from there.
And I totally expect that the service will make it super easy to do that. You're going to be very flexible with the information.
Yeah.
And then I think we already covered, you know, being able to analyze the data and do is something we already covered. I think that's a key aspect of intelligent systems, and providing a good user experience. I guess I think what was that thermostat that Google bought? What was that company?
Nest.
See, that was a good example of something that had a very easy to use user experience, right? And was a user literally had to do nothing, and it just kind of worked. I think the Nest was a good example of an IoT in action. Cool. Well, I think that's a nice, really nice discussion for something that we didn't think we knew a whole lot about. So I'm glad we have this this little chat over here. Anything else you guys want to share before we wrap up here?
No, I think we should just put it on our future to-dos, that when we, you know, maybe come back and revisit this particular one in 6 months as we get more details out.
Absolutely. And just in case our listeners are wondering, so I will put a link to the form where you can kind of ask for access, early access to this service. If you think that you can relate to any of the discussion we just had today, well, we'll encourage you guys to sign up for the service. And as soon as Microsoft's ready to roll it out to you, they'll make it available to you, and then in a few months from then, it'll be available publicly. And you know, that's when, as Evan says, we'll have a deeper dive into it.
Yeah, right. one other link I saw just 2 days ago. I don't know all the details, but we'll put it in the link dump. Is about this OneDrive for Business increase. Did you see this, guys?
Didn't it go up to like a terabyte or something like that per?
So corporate customers that had 25 gig available originally now get a terabyte included.
Are you serious?
That's, yeah, it's like, it's pretty air shattering. Like as far as the size, I was like, wow, that's outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, that for me, that, you know, that almost is to the point where I look at it and go, okay, so I on my laptops that maybe don't have quite as much space as my other machines, I just, you know, unsync certain folders, but I can just move everything I have out there.
Yep.
And then I just, oh, I have a new machine, just, you know, set up my OneDrive for Business account, and boom, there's all my files.
Okay. And that's a good point. It's not important, I guess, not related to the topic today, but just in general in terms of Azure. They're retiring the 1.x Azure guest operating system Evan, do you know anything about this?
Yeah, that's for the PaaS roles. Oh, okay. So that's the 2008 kind of based OS. And we're moving to very soon where you got to be 2008 R2 or higher.
I see. Okay, so I know, I think you and I had to have a discussion one time because I had one of my services that was lying around that had this, and took a little bit of troubleshooting from Evan's team to figure out where it was. But I was able to delete it, I think, and I recreated it under a newer version of that.
Yeah, you can actually upgrade these.
You can upgrade too, yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to redeploy your package, though, to
right.
do it.
Right. So I just wasn't using it. It was just lying there, so I just deleted it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Evan, but they're automatic by default, right? Like unless you go in and change the config, it will automatically use the latest OS, no?
I believe you are correct about that. And if it's not a default, it's one of those things where it's like right in your face of you know, you can just flip the setting and change it either way.
Yep.
But I'm pretty sure you're right that by default we just always upgrade you. But a lot of people, you know, for lots of obvious reasons, will say, hey, I want to fix it at this OS version. You'll get the patches, but you won't get OS upgrades.
Yep. Right. And then a couple of other cool updates. The MongoDB, I believe we're going to be getting that as a database as a service offering in Microsoft Azure. So look for that to come. We'll put a link to that announcement from Scott Guthrie. Well, I think that's a wrap then. So thanks, guys, for a lovely discussion today on intelligent system service, which is soon to come.
Sounds great. See you guys in a week.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.